Hiya, Wanju, hello, welcome to another episode of The Curb. I'm Andrew F. Pierce, and this is a podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and curators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boolu, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded. And today it's also recorded from Naam, Melbourne, Victoria. And it's less of an interview, more of a discussion, because I'm back with my colleague Nadine Whitney to discuss the work that we both did on the umbrella releases for Eyes Without a Face and Hounds of Love. And we also discuss the importance of supplementary materials that come with physical media releases, alongside the work that goes into writing or creating essays for physical media releases. We also discuss other current releases from our umbrella, including Metal Skin and the upcoming release Storm Warning, and our cinematic recommendations for this week as well, which you'll have to listen to at the end of the episode. Umbrella Entertainment are currently having a sale on their physical media, which includes a buy one, get one free selection and 30% off merch and select collector's editions, including the two main editions that we discuss in this episode, Hounds of Love and Eyes Without a Face. To buy these editions, visit umbrellaent.com.au. I will stick a link in the show notes. And additionally, if you want to find out more about what we do on The Curb, then head over to thecurb.com.au. We are a completely independent and ad-free website, lives on support of listeners and readers just like yourself. Visit patreon.com/thecurbau, where you can support our work from as little as $1 a month. Right, that's enough from me solo. Stick around after the trailer and you'll be able to hear myself and Nadine discuss the two main releases, Eyes Without a Face and Hounds of Love from Umbrella Entertainment.
Hey, love. Do you want a lift?
Oh, are you sure?
Yeah, just jump in.
Pretty little diary.
Your mum wouldn't let you out, so you snuck out, didn't you?
She's probably not even looking for you.
You think she's prettier than me?
Come on, Evie. You're my queen.
Pourquoi mens-tu? Depuis le temps que je te connais, je lis sur ton visage. Dis-moi la vérité.
It's nice to be back to be able to talk about reviewing and talking about films and physical media and all this kind of stuff. Although this episode, we're not going to really delve into reviewing stuff because one of the joys of the work that we get to do, and by we, I mean myself, Andrew Pierce, and my colleague, Nadine, who's joining me all the way from Naam, Melbourne, is that Hello. We get to talk about physical media. So thank you. Yeah.
Well, we don't even simply talk about it. We contribute to it, which
Yes.
is a whole new ball game.
Yeah, and so we've both done some interesting releases that have come out of Umbrella Entertainment recently. Two of the titles which I'd love to talk to you about, and we'll probably start talking about Eyes Without a Face, because that's a film that I watched far too young and left a mark on me. And you wrote some essays for that particular, or an essay for that particular film. And I'm curious if you can talk about your process of engaging with writing an essay and revisiting such a powerful horror film in a modern context.
Well, I see Eyes Without a Face until I was in my 30s anyway. So I actually have to shout out here to Alexandra Hellenicholas, because I was living in her garage at the time. And she would have things sent through whilst she was studying, and we were writing a magazine called Fiend, which was kind of a dark culture-music-film zine but glossy. And she put on Eyes Without a Face one night, and I just sat there with my mouth agape going, this is one of the most beautiful and eerie things I've ever seen. And I didn't actually know a lot about Georges Franju at the time. And honestly, he other than a few things, the Codex stuff and a fairly standard crime piece, he didn't do a lot as a director that really got noted. So when it came to writing about Eyes Without a Face, I rewatched it about 7 times, because that's the, I mean, I that's the thing I do, is I rewatch and I rewatch and I write notes and I rewatch and I analyze scenes, and then I go, what else does this feed into? What is it similar to? And you know, do a huge dive into films around it and the history around it and the critical reception at the time. So for me, writing about it, I wrote about the sort of fairy tale aspect and sadism. For the father character in it, because you know it's a law of control.
And there is, I mean, as you mentioned with the fairy tale aspect, like the one of the most iconic shots is obviously the end, and you know, her getting out into escaping the place, and it feels I'm fascinated. I haven't actually got this release and I need to pick it up, and I know that there's a sale on at the moment, so 30% off, and I might actually grab it, because I'd love to read that and delve into that mindset of the fairy tale side of it, because it does feel a bit like Snow White escaping, you know, at the end. There is that sense of relief, which is so beautifully presented there.
Well, also with the doves fluttering behind her. Yeah, and I wrote about evil fathers in fairy tales and what their modus is, and it often is control, you know, shaping their daughter into a marriageable entity, and sometimes marrying them themselves. For example, in Donkey Skin, that's the and Mossy Coat, both of those are Cinderella variations, where the father is actually going to try to marry the daughter. So not the healthiest thing.
No, but also, I mean, I think that's what is so well presented too in the film. And it's obviously, it's not leaning into the comment on that particular relationship of a father wanting to marry his daughter. But I think the clinical side of stuff is really well presented, and that is also the aspect that really sticks in my mind, of the deterioration of her face and the shots, the photos that we see of her face deteriorating. Mm-hmm. And that is such a visceral image of this person putting his daughter through so much just to try and retain or regain some kind of beauty, or his version of beauty. And it's so cruel and devastating. And yet, what's the end goal? And as you're talking about trying to have this relationship with his daughter that way, oh, it's that lingers so strongly in my mind. Ah, oh, it's so powerful.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And Franju actually spent a lot of time investigating medical films to get a sense of verisimilitude for those surgery scenes. Trepanation was something he was very interested in, and there is a documentary that was very highly regarded by the French New Wave. They did before that, which was In a Slaughterhouse. So this, it's like this fantastic film is completely against the kind of French New Wave ideas of a kind of revolutionary standings, but it was informed by medical practices at the time and medical practices over history and what he had observed within making his films on the slaughterhouse. And
that's part of the physical release as well. I remember watching that ahead of watching Eyes Without a Face because it's on the Criterion Collection edition as well. But it's an unsettling film, that's for sure.
Yeah. So I mean, he's a fascinating director who I don't think ever really got his due. He's kind of a bit like sorry about my Czech, Hertz in Czechoslovakia, as it was at the time, you know, who was making these incredible pieces like Morgiana and his Beauty and the Beast, but was completely kept out of the kind of Czech New Wave. So Fanjou had the same thing, that he was on the edges. And when he brought his film to America, they didn't know what to do with it. And Pauline Kael was one of the few people who actually reviewed it, and you know, people passed out because of the surgery scene with him, the doctor, removing a face.
I'm curious then as well, because I know Umbrella's released a bunch of French extremity films too, and I know that you've been part of some of those releases in some capacity. I'm just trying to bring it up on the screen. But films like Martyrs and stuff like that, where you just have these really, really intense. And I remember watching Martyrs for the first time back when that first came out. And I think that I have a fairly strong will of being able to endure stuff. But that film really pushed me to the edge in a way that I didn't expect. And I think that, you know, certainly modern sensibilities has become a little bit dulled to those kinds of extreme things. And I think that Eyes Without a Face would probably be a little bit easier to watch nowadays because we're so used to seeing that kind of imagery. But then Martyrs for me was something I was just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that we're going to this length. And so it might have been that feeling that audiences had when Eyes Without a Face first came out of that, oh my gosh, I can't believe that they're actually putting this on screen.
Yeah, it was 1960, so it's in the same ballpark, I guess, as Psycho, the same release cycle as Psycho's, which I guess is a real shift in the way that cinema was perceived in terms of horror. What makes horror? It's not haunting. It's not, you know, this supernatural thing, it's actually the actions of human beings. And that in itself is frightening, because before that you kind of have noir and it's a criminal aspect that you're looking at. And then you have sort of 50s sci-fi, which as Robin Wood explained in his book, Hollywood from Vietnam to Reagan and beyond, was looking at the sense of the other coming into society. So these were people from the outside, aliens from the outside. But when you look at something like Psycho and Eyes Without a Face, Psycho is your, you know, Norman Bates is ostensibly your everyday guy in a space which should be safe, which is a hotel. And the horror comes from his psychological damage. With the doctor, he's a fated doctor in society. You know, he's giving speeches. He has a position which makes him not in any way even seem like a mad scientist. The whole burns relief thing is this amazing thing that he's going to do for humanity. But within that is his psychological breakdown, which brings the horror home. And I think that that's something that people weren't quite prepared for, the extent of the horror within the human psyche that wasn't coming from outside. It was coming from inside the home. And that's what frightened them, I think, more than anything.
Yeah. It's a good kind of pivot point to being able to talk about Hounds of Love, because that's the foundation of my essay. But before we do that, I want to just talk about the other things, the special features that are on the Eyes Without a Face Collector's Edition, because this is a good kind of mindset that I want people to understand about what it means to be part of a collection. And so there's a whole bunch of different things, and I'll just run through this while you're off doing that. So the physical collection comes this beautiful 4K disc alongside a poster and all this kind of stuff, replica lobby cards and all these different things. There's a slipcase and all this kind of stuff. That all looks lovely, and it's one of the delights of being able to get an Umbrella Collection disc is that it looks stunning on your shelf. But then your essay is featured alongside essays from Stephen Thrower and Jack Sargent. And then there's also a video essay from the great Dr. Lindsay Hallam as well. And I'm curious if you can talk about the role of being part of a critical collective who elevates or explores the impact of a film in
Well,
such a way.
I mean, to begin with, it's an honor always to be put on a disc with people like Stephen Thrower and Lindsay Hallam, and to have Jack Sargent reach out to me, it's like I always pinch myself when I get an offer to do these things. What I love about this particular release is that it's each essay comes from some kind of sidestep in a way. Like there's a very base historical essay which talks about Plongeon, but then you've got work like Jack Sargent's The Blood of Beasts, and he's talking about Le Sang de Bête, which is the documentary, The Slaughterhouse, and how these kinds of things lead into Eyes Without a Face. You've got all the alternative art, which is gorgeous. Like shout out to the designer Stephanie Viollo, who has been doing some beautiful, beautiful work. When you get control, that's beautiful. But yeah, it's I don't even know how to describe being part of a critical community like this. It's overwhelmingly positive and affirming, I think, because often it's a very lonely job, as you know. I mean, you talk to more people than I do because you do interviews, but it's a solitary job being a critic. You sit, you watch, you type, you make notes, you're in your head all the time, you're attached to the screen. But to know that you're making something that is going to go across the world with a whole bunch of people who you deeply admire is, I'm not sure how to describe it. It's so satisfying. What about for you, Andrew, when you were doing it?
It's satisfying, but it's a feeling of validation, I guess is the best way of putting it, of going, okay, I'm doing something that matters, that actually carries weight and importance. And like I wrote an essay for Hounds of Love, and the reaction to that film, I mean, I live in Boulu, Perth, and as I mentioned in the essay, the film was shot just a couple of streets away from my house, which I didn't realize until I sat in the cinema and watched the film and went, "What the fuck have you done, Ben Young?"
Now that's bringing the
But I also want to stress as well, because the Hounds of Love is adjacent to one of the key crimes that took place in Perth, which is the Burnies. And the Burnies, I don't think that people are aware of kind of the domesticity of their crimes and how close their crimes are to basically the center of Perth. The house that that those crimes took place in was in Willoughby, which where I currently live is two suburbs away. My partner, she lived two streets away from their house. She wasn't there at the time that the crimes took place, of course. But for anybody outside of Perth, that notion is like it taking place in Carlton, you know, or St Kilda, right? So really, really close to the proximity of the centre of the city. It's not very far away. Like if you stand on a hill in Willoughby, you can actually see Perth City pretty clearly. And so all of that leads into Hounds of Love. And it's not, I know Ben wouldn't talk about it in relation to that particular crime because it is informed by multiple other crimes that have taken place in Perth, including the Claremont killings and things like that. But all of those things took place and shook up domesticity and suburbia in a way that really, really changed how we saw our little sleepy death toll town. And that's what we call ourselves, a sleepy death toll town. Dullesville is another name that we have.
Which is the name of your
essay. It is indeed. Yeah. And
can I quote from your essay?
You can if you want, yeah.
I'm going to. because it actually speaks to exactly what you're speaking to, which is each layer of normalcy is warped by Young's furious questioning of how this level of violence was able to continue for so long. So because you're saying that it, you explain it to me as Carlton or wherever, I've got stories about crime in Carlton, but when I was living there, but that's the question, you know. You start to have to question your neighbours, and that's a key thing in horror, in itself. But this is running the true crime gauntlet and horror, which is, you know, difficult. It's the Snowtown effect, you know. It's something.
And I think, I mean, the aspect of Hounds of Love and Snowtown too is the level of violation that takes place, because obviously Australia's got so many different crime stories. A lot of them are gangland or that kind of stuff. And they don't really intrigue me or excite me or get me interested, nor does this kind of storytelling either. And that's the thing which I find really complicated is our relationship to different sorts of crimes. There's the choppers, the animal kingdoms, underbelly and that kind of stuff. And there's that feels very basic because in the sense that, well, they're not coming after me. They're coming after their other, you know, the opposing gang or whatever. Like, I'm not going to get in the crosshair of that. And so I can sit as a spectator. Whereas something like Hounds of Love or Snowtown is, it is very explicit that, like, young women, gay people, all of these kinds of vulnerable communities in a way. And I think Ben really paints it so brilliantly in the opening of Hounds of Love, where the notion of the community being vulnerable wasn't in the mindset of people in the 1980s, right? Certainly in Perth, it wasn't like, I can walk home with no issues whatsoever and I'm not going to be violated. And those opening shots, which are quite calming, and then he impacts and throws in this slow motion tracking shot, which just unnerves you and unsettles you. And again, like, that netball court, not very far away from where I used to live. And so this changing of the normalcy of how we perceive the safety of our suburbs and the safety of our communities. And again, gangland violence, certainly in Perth, that doesn't really impact us. We don't really think about it. Like, it's something that happens to other people. But I don't know anybody, certainly in the 1990s, because that's more of the era that I grew up, but I don't know anybody who was not connected to a victim of the Claremont killings at all. Like, Perth is such a small place. We have this term, and I'm sure that probably Melbourne or Sydney have got a similar term, but basically we have a term called Perthed. You've been Perthed. and it means that if
you perp.
Yeah, like so
explain.
So what it means is if you go overseas, and this happens, everybody from Perth has got a similar story. You go overseas and suddenly you encounter an Australian and they're like, where are you from? And mm-hmm. they're like, well, I'm from Perth. You might not have heard of it. It's a small town in Western Australia. And you go, well, actually, I'm from Perth too. And they're like, oh, really? Where do you live? And you go, well, I live here. And they're like, oh, wow, I live here as well. And suddenly you've got a connection. You know that person's family member or anything like that. We know everybody pretty well here. And so the connection to crime and violence in the way of Claremont, in the way of the Burnies, its proximity to us is really, really close. And that's something that I think Ben really puts forward in such a devastating way in Hounds of Love, especially in the opening and in the closing shots as well, where we get this glimpse of suburbia and the mum just crying out in the street for her daughter and nobody knowing what's really going on, because again, at that time, well, it can't happen to us. You know, why would it happen to us? And so all of that underpins my essay, and being able to write about it from a personal perspective, from a Perth perspective, was quite a pleasure. And additionally, like, again, my abject anger and fury at Ben, and I've told him this as well, for having created this film and changed how I see Perth, how I see my suburbs, was tangible. When I got out of the cinema, I was really absolutely furious. I hated this film for so long. And I do still have such a complicated relationship with it, because it is such a dark and depressing film, and it is so visceral with its violation, just like Snowtown is. And you don't have to name any particular titles or anything like that, but I'm curious then for you, like, when we're writing about a film that we don't entirely resonate with or we don't love, that becomes then very difficult, right? And Hounds of Love, I can see that it's a great yes. film in a lot of different ways, but I still push off against it. Having, like you mentioned, with watching Eyes Without a Face 7 times over, I watched Hounds of Love twice, and that was as much as I could do.
Well, I mean, some of the films that are put out are quite challenging. For example, Metal Skin, when I was watching Metal Skin, it's quite a challenging film. It's deliberately ugly. And I think that would be, not argued in any point, that it's a deliberately depressing and ugly film. The ugliness is, you know, the end point. Everything is moving towards this death, this entropic end. So there's no, for me, there was no pleasure in watching it several times. But there was certainly something that I grasped onto that was interesting within the film. So to write about something that eventually, because as I said, you do have to watch it more than once, and you have to be, very involved in how you're watching it. For me, I kind of go into this side lane of saying, so what am I seeing here in the film that is resonating and is going to keep the film being relevant? And for me, when I was looking at Metal Skin, I was looking at the psychogeography of Melbourne, and that's also in Romper Stomper too. And everything that the director has done, except for Cherry Falls, there's a very strong sense of place. So even in his Macbeth, which was very underseen, there's an extremely strong sense of almost being in the city, but not quite. Like you don't quite. They're turf wars. You don't quite own the space that you're in. or the space that you're in is just a little bit too far from being involved in what matters, what apparently matters. So they're fringe groups. And in Mental Skin with the illegal car racing, it's a fringe group. So, like, when you were having trouble, well, not trouble, but, you know, when you were doing the House of Love and going, this is a tough watch again, I had a similar aspect with Metal Skin. It's just like, Metal Skin is very interesting, but as an experience, it's quite depressing.
Yeah.
So,
but I think that's the thing as well, is that our work as writers or commentary or visual essays and stuff like that, again, they might be dark or complicated films to engage with, but I would hope that the work we do in those kinds of supplemental materials really helps context and or apply context and place and time and relevance and importance as well to the film and the work of the filmmaker, and elevate or amplify or explore what it is that they were saying on screen or have been saying, like in the case of Eyes Without a Face, have been saying in their career, which is, you know, equally important, being able to look at their previous work and seeing how it impacts their future work. And I did that a little bit as well with Hounds of Love, although it's a bit difficult too, because I think Ben is a little bit like some of the other filmmakers. Justin Kurzel is a good example. An Australian filmmaker who takes a true crime adjacent story and then suddenly they've got a name for themselves. And then, of course, one of their next films is then stepping into Hollywood blockbuster territory. And that's what Ben did. He went off to Romania, I think it was, and shot a film over there with Michael Peña. And then, of course, Justin Kurzel going from Snowtown, not directly, but eventually onto then doing the Assassin's Creed film as well, which is like, you know, not staying in the same wheelhouse, but almost running as far away from it as possible to say that was an experience. I don't particularly want to return to that comfortably anytime soon. I need to go to the polar opposite of what that is. Of course, Kurzel went and did Nitram down the line, which I think is a far more sensitive film than Snowtown, but we're not talking about him. We're talking about Hounds of Love. But yeah, I just find all of this work, and that's, again, it's the joy of being able to pick up a physical media thing. And most of the time, like, I'm tend to be buying stuff that I have already seen. So I've already seen the film and I'm exclusively picking it up for the essays, for the commentary. What's your kind of, like, when you buy a physical media release, what are you looking for?
Well, when I buy it, the deluxe versus just the DVD, I guess, is the question, because, you know, you can just get the DVD, which might have an audio commentary on it, or you can get the one with the booklet and the essays. Okay, the reasons I tend to buy the ones with the essays is that I like going to film classes. essentially, I like doing my cinema degree, and I get to do my cinema degree all over again when I read the works of, you know, fated critics like Alexandra Helen Nicholas, Pat Ellinger, Lindsay Hallam, you know, a whole bunch of people that, you know, just enrich what I'm looking at. You know, every night I go to sleep with a film podcast on, or, you know, so I'm, at least it's getting in there somewhere that I'm constantly learning. So yeah, I just really like to know what they know and what they thought. And sometimes I like to know what they thought in terms of whether it aligned with what I thought, or whether it's giving me something, a new insight that I'd never thought of before. So if I can, I always go for the deluxe thing. It's not for the posters or for the art cards. It's partly for the graphic design because I like graphic design, but it's always for those essays, for the history of the people involved, you know, for the documentaries that are added to the disc, the short films that are added to the disc, and you know, the critical appraisals, as well as the interviews with the directors or other people who were involved in the production. So yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff was kind of almost the standard on DVDs for years. That, you know, we wouldn't get all the booklet, but we'd get, you know, this range of extras where you could go deep into the film. I mean, I haven't gotten rid of most of my DVDs because the extras are so good. And then that kind of went away, and we waited for boutique labels like BFI or Criterion to do that. But in Australia, we have Man to an extent, although often they're very bare bones. We have Umbrella, who are just kicking back, and we have Imprint, who are doing great work. Don't know what happened to Hopscotch. What happened to Hopscotch?
Hopscotch retired. It got morphed into something else. I think it got changed into E1, and then like E1 Australia, and then it transitioned into something else. I was literally just watching the Hopscotch thing.
People listening at home, I just did as the sound of a fluorescent light.
Yes.
It was the Hopscotch logo.
Yeah, which is, I mean, you feel very nostalgic about it because there was something, again, it's the mark of quality, right? And it's the importance of being able to have a stamp of approval to say, we feel that this is worthwhile dedicating time and resources to providing something, you know, of importance. And I look at some of the upcoming releases for for Umbrella in particular, and it's like they've been doing the Ozploitation Rarities series, which is great. And again, mentioning the New Extremity series, they've done an excellent job of the Wake and Fright restoration, and then also the Fall restoration, which you've been part of too. But then additionally, bringing forward films like Ten Canoes, for example, which is just, I'm thrilled that that's getting a re-release. And then something like Storm Warning, which is a film that I do not like at all, but I'll be reviewing the disc and having a look at it in the future. Mostly because I'm fascinated, and again, comes back to the critical stuff. I'm fascinated by the commentary. That particular disc has got a commentary with director Jamie Blanks and Cameron Cairns, obviously from Late Night with the Devil fame. There's a whole bunch of other stuff as well on there. There's essays. So it's the critical reassessment of stuff. And if I like the film, great. That makes me like it even more. But I particularly like the challenge of knowing I did not like this film at all. I thought that it was absolutely terrible. However, these great minds might be able to shine a light on why it carries importance or encourage me to see it in a different light. And that's what I'm hoping, particularly with a release like Storm Warning, that, you know, my perspective on the film has changed a little bit because I want to see why it's valuable or why it's important. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I just have to say shout out to Jamie Blanks, who is an absolutely lovely, lovely, lovely man. And I look forward to hearing what he has to say. I mean, most people know Jamie from his Hollywood work, which includes Valentine and Urban Legend. But, you know, he's a Melbourne boy. And, you know, he was friends with my friends. You know, he lives just outside of Melbourne now. And so seeing him, like listening to him kind of talk about why he was remaking sort of, you know, Ozploitation classics is going to be, I think, very interesting.
And especially working alongside someone like Everett De Roche as well, who had such a major impact on the Ozploitation era. So it'd be interesting to at least see that. And revisiting, I mean, there's so many different people as well. Justin Dix as well did the special effects for that film. No doubt, I'll talk about it. I'm spending a lot of time talking about Storm Warning. But it's something, again, coming back to that notion of getting to review and see what a film is like. And
getting to hear
what
from,
I love about this.
Getting to hear from the person involved, the people involved, as well as getting different critical perspectives that you might not have even considered. Because, you know, for me, for example, you know, a lot of my film watching, it's never passive because I can't turn my brain off. I mean, it's always, my film watching is always critical. My television watching is completely passive. It's like, I don't care. You know, do whatever. Oh, that character's dead. Bye. But my film watching, I just can't turn my brain off. So, but I'm not reviewing every title I watch, and I'm not doing deep dives in every title I watch. So getting to have that experience of reading or listening to those deep dives is, I think, just incredible. And when it comes from, you know, the director themselves or people who are involved in the film or just really stellar critics, it's great. And, you know, what another thing I want to point out too, that it's quite important to get different voices on these releases. You know, if you're, there are people who are experts in Australian film like yourself, but, you know, there are films set and made in places where people lived at the time, which is why it's so important that you got to write on Ben Young's piece. But, for example, Love and Other Catastrophes, which Umbrella put out, you know, I was at Melbourne Uni. That was my milieu. I didn't work on that piece, but, you know, if people were to reach out to the voices who kind of lived part of that as well, that's very important.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it comes back to, as you're saying, like way back in the day, the dawn of DVDs and Laserdisc too, but Laserdisc wasn't a huge thing in Australia. It was the norm to have the director talking about the film. It was the norm to be able to have that kind of masterclass in it. And as you talk about, like, it being a film class, and that's really it. It's a democratization of going to film school, but in your living room. and
yeah,
then getting to hear from people who lived around there or experienced the culture, the era. They're not cultural tourists. They're actual people who lived and breathed and engaged with what was going on. And that's equally important and vital. And I'm making it sound like we're doing the God's work, but on a cultural perspective, as arrogant as this might be, yeah, we kind of are. Like, and that's the thing, is that it's really, really important to be able to provide that cultural context. And you talked about it in Love and Other Catastrophes. You talked about it, you know, in understanding the history of Melbourne. And yes, me as somebody from Perth could probably do that and look at it and go, well, this, and this. But I'll be taking it from books or films or music or whatever, or news articles from the time. Whereas you're taking it as somebody who lives and breathes Melbourne and knows what that culture is like and has been like and how it's changed over the years. It's vitally important. You know, it helps us see our world in a different way.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it needs to be limited to people who have the lived experience. I mean, I you know, I find you, for example, is dead. And, you know, so we're not going to hear from him specifically. We're going to hear from other voices. And, you know, when you're doing something like French Extremity, you don't have to hear from voices all over the world. Unless everybody speaks French, and which they don't. But I think that when you're looking at Australian releases, it's really important to kind of center them on the Australian experience. And a lot of people, I don't know if anybody's going to be listening to this from overseas. You should, because we're nice. We know our country, even though our country is very wide and very, very different. And like each city is quite different. We are still aware of what's happening in each of our states and each of our country, in all parts of our country. And, we as settlers or colonists, we all understand our role as people who were invited onto this land and do not own it, and the importance of understanding what that land was, which is something that I went into in Metal Skin. I talked about where it was set and how it was and when it was set and how it was just land taken several times over and over. This land has been taken, is taken from the indigenous people, then it was taken from immigrants who'd settled in it. And I think that those kinds of experiences are something that you kind of know if you're here.
Yeah, of course. I guess as we kind of lead into wrapping up, on our next chat, we're going to be talking about, you're going to be talking about Control, which has a beautiful, beautiful cover and physical release. Looks absolutely just stunning. And then I'll be also talking about something very, very different, which is a surfing documentary called You Should Have Been Here Yesterday, which came out last year. And again, it's that one of the joys of Umbrella is that they look backwards in time, from the 1950s, and then they look to 2024. And so they're not just elevating old films, they're elevating new films and giving it the time and dedication that it deserves as well. So I'm really looking forward to being able to discuss both of those. It's been a very long time since I've seen Control, so I'm looking forward to kind of delving into that and seeing if my perspective on that has changed at all. But before we wrap up, cinema recommendations. What's out in the
Oh,
cinema at the
okay.
moment? Yeah.
What's out in the cinema at the moment? Look, I hope people have had a chance to see it, but Tracy Lehman's Bob Trevino Likes It is devastatingly beautiful and kind, and based on the her own story of dealing with her narcissistic father who cuts her off. In this case, Tracy is fictionally played by Barbie Frere, as Lily Trevino, who's dealing with her extremely difficult narcissistic father, Robert Bob Trevino, played by French Stewart in a completely different type of role than we're used to. And poor Lily is in people-pleasing mode all the time. She just doesn't know what to do. She's frozen with terror. If she gets angry, if she doesn't please people, things will go horrifically wrong. And just due to a kind of slip of the tongue, she's blamed by Robert for ruining a date, and he cuts her off. And she doesn't know what to do when he cuts her off. So she calls him and calls him, and he won't answer the phone. And then on Facebook, she sees a name, Bob Trevino, and clicks friend. And it turns out that this Bob Trevino isn't her dad, but it's another man called Bob Trevino, played absolutely gorgeously by, yes, who has his own sadnesses, and they come together in just this incredible friendship which enriches both their lives. And so it's turning a story like anybody who has a difficult parent will be very confronted by this, but also comforted. I spoke to Tracy, and I've still got a long piece to send that people will be able to read. I would say that it is a completely 4-star hashtag best movie ever, 4 or 5-star hashtag best movie ever thing. And Tracy Layman herself is authentically wonderful, and she has turned her pain into the most extraordinary kindness. And it's a great film.
Well, that's a good recommendation. It is on my list to watch. I need to get to that point where I can comfortably watch it, but I will get there. With that said, my kind of quick cinema recommendation, keeping with Umbrella, is Sally Aitken's Every Little Thing is my second favorite Australian film from 2024. It's now actually got a proper full release in Australian cinemas. It's been out for a few weeks, but if you want a gift for yourself, and maybe even a loved one as well, go and see Every Little Thing in a cinema. It's just one of the most phenomenal documentaries I've seen in a long, long time. It follows a wildlife carer it's a documentary, so she's playing herself, but yeah, and very well too.
And wildlife yeah. carer, who is, yes, she, yes, the reality yeah. of it is extraordinary. No, I am kidding. It's a great film. Yeah. I'm seconding Andrew's recommendation.
But Terry Messier is her name. She's in Hollywood, Los Angeles, and she tends to and looks after a bunch of hummingbirds who come through her care, and rehab that she does with them is just, oh my gosh. There's like the work that she dedicates and puts into, you know, restoring and looking after these lovely little creatures is beautiful. But on the same hand as well, she also talks about the fragility of life and the impermanence of existence. And when the film does contain death, it does contain some of the hummingbirds passing away, but it's not presented in a mournful way. It's not presented in a way of, I can't believe they're dead, that kind of thing. It's presented in a way of, we're lucky that they existed in the first place. They're only here for a short period of time. And when she buries them in the ground, and this is one of the things of many that has stuck with, and I've watched this film 6-7 times now, seen it twice in a cinema, and both times I just wept with joy and sadness and then joy again, because of the way that Sally Aitken captures it. But specifically talking about the death, she buries two these lovely little hummingbirds, and then she talks about how in just a matter of days that they will have returned to the soil and their physical bodies no longer exist. And it's a beautiful, beautiful scene. But again, it just makes us remember that life happens and it's fleeting and then it disappears. And I know Sally has been touring around with this film for, well, ever since Sundance last year. And so she's been on a nonstop whirlwind of visiting all these places around the world. And when they were in Los Angeles earlier this year for the launch there, it was days after the fires there had decimated that particular region. And I know that for her, she spent so long shooting the film in Hollywood. And so to see the areas that have been impacted, that she shot, and, you know, that these hummingbirds live, and it just changed the way that she saw the world. Just like this film, it may not change the way that everybody sees the world, but for me, it has left such a major mark on me that I'm still just so in love of this film. And yes, the title Every Little Thing does refer to the Bob Marley song, and we do hear that at the end. But I think that's the sensibility that Sally Aitken is going for, and she has done. I just love and adore her work as a documentarian and the way that she sees the world. She previously did a film called Playing with Sharks, which I just absolutely adore, and she knows that tragedy and trauma exist, but also beauty and delight exists, and everything will be okay.
Well, one of the things that is important in the film is that hummingbirds are pollinators. So they may exist for a short period of time, and they're magical. Like, they're magical. They shouldn't be able to do what they do. Like, they have to have all this sugar and energy so they can just stay afloat, with their wings beating at extreme rates. But within their short lifespan, they pollinate and they make sure that life goes on. They create life. And I think that one of the things I found so extraordinary in the documentary is that as Sally is talking to Terry, we get a sense of Terry's own life and how she has become, through pain and death and trauma, a pollinator herself, in caring for the birds, but also just in the immense education that she has about the wilderness, the
Yeah.
environment, and yeah.
And by extension as well, Sally becomes a cinematic pollinator too. And that's a it's a rare gift to be able to do what she does. Again, I have such a huge admiration for her empathy on screen and the level of support for her subjects that she has. I've done countless interviews with her. I've spoken with her multiple times. No doubt I will again talk with her in the future. She is one of my favorite filmmakers because of just the way that she sees the world. And I think that every little thing is probably, right now, it's the best thing that she's done. So again, go and see it in cinema if you haven't. Gift yourself this film. It's beautiful. And
And go and see Bob Trevino, another film about trauma and
yeah.
kindness.
Exactly. All right. Well, that's about it from now. From us. From now. From now. From now. Who knows?
Well,
What
for
are
now,
words? What
for
are
now.
words? Yeah.
Who knows?
We will be back again in the future. Talk about Control. Talk about You Shouldn't Have Been Here Yesterday. We'll also probably talk
You
of
should have
You
been here
Should Have Been Here
yesterday.
Yesterday.
Yeah, what are words,
Yeah.
Andrew, please?
I've been up since 6 o'clock this morning and I've done one interview, done this chat. In 10 minutes, I'll jump on another interview.
Oh, ex excuses,
And then I've got
excuses.
another interview and then all of this. And you know where you can, this is what we call a segue, you see, where you can find those interviews and reviews and all that other stuff is thecurb.com.au. Follow Nadine on social media at what's your handle?
I got Nadine Whitney on Blue Sky, Nadine 13 AM on Insta, and I don't know, I use the Oz Critic account on Facebook to put my stuff up as well. But just if you want to find my reviews, they're on Rotten Tomatoes.
Fantastic. And I'll make sure to stick a link in the show notes as well. And if you go into umbrellaent.com.au, you can find all of the releases that we've talked about today, the physical media releases. And then you can also go down a rabbit hole and try and find all the other ones that Nadine has worked on as well, including the Kim Kaidok set of films, which we're going to talk about, but I'll probably talk about that on the next one, because I love his work. I know that he's slightly problematic as a person, but that doesn't matter. Well, it does matter, but when
Well,
you've got a
he's dead
film
now.
like, he's dead now, yeah. When you've got a film like
That
Spring,
sounded
Summer,
so
Fall, Winter,
harsh.
and Spring
He's
to your name,
dead
yeah. But yeah. So many different releases that are on there. Go and spend some money. They have a sale on at the moment, 30% off some films, and then also buy one, get one free too. So yeah, umbrellaent.com.au. Nadine, thank you as always.
But I'm going to just say I'm also going to be talking a lot about the fall. So,
Oh yes. Yes, we will. I think we might dedicate a whole episode to talking about The Fall because I'm very
oh,
excited
look,
to be able to talk
it's a
about that.
masterpiece. Okay, thank you everyone for listening.